Active History is pleased to present a recording of Ruth Sandwell's talk, The 1860s and the Origins of Canada's Transitions to Fossil Fuels. The talk was delivered on April 22, 2017, as part of The Other 60s, a decade that shaped Canada and the world, a symposium hosted by the Department of History at the University of Toronto.
My paper today is part of a larger project called Heat, Light, and Work in the Canadian Home, A Social History of Energy, 1860 to 1960. For Canadian energy historians, the 1860s stands out in the historical record as a decade when fossil fuels made their first sustained impact on the Canadian economy, environment, and the practices of everyday life. As historians of energy are fond of pointing out, the slow replacement of energies of the organic regime of wood, wind, water, and muscle power with those of the industrial regime of coal, oil, gas, and electricity has changed just about every aspect of life for people in industrialized societies, from the way people travel, communicate, and eat, to the way they work, play, and even think. Fossil fuels have made cities possible. They've made global economies possible. Over the past 20 years or so, as people around the world struggle to take in the bad news from scientists about the environmental consequences of burning the fossil fuels through their effect on climate change, people are beginning to wonder how they're going to negotiate the next energy transition to a low-carbon future. But in the 1860s, Canadians were just beginning to experience the first great energy transition from the organic to the mineral or industrial regime. In the 1860s, coal was just beginning to make an appearance with Canadian transportation and manufacturing, though even railways were still being powered primarily by wood right into the 1870s. The modern energy regime was making its first dramatic appearance, not as heat or power, but as a new form of lighting, which I've given away by this, my first slide here. So yes, lighting, what I call energy history's neglected little sister, was in fact the first form of fossil fuel that Canadians embraced, as it were. The adoption of petroleum lighting in the 1860s led the transition to fossil fuel energy in Canada, and with some significant social, economic, and environmental consequences. Of all the revolutions in lighting, including electricity, none was taken up more quickly, this is globally as well as in Canada, none was taken up more quickly or embraced more widely than the kerosene lamp, also known as paraffin or petroleum, and most often in Canada it's called the coal oil lamp for reasons that we'll look at in a minute. Kerosene became known as the measure of success of all the new lighting forms of the 19th and indeed the 20th century. While today we consume huge quantities of artificial light, just look around the room, without giving it much thought, and I just recently read the statistic that today we're consuming about 6,500 times more artificial light than people did in 1800, as opposed to 200 to 300% more of other kinds of energy. So people in the pre-industrial era, they organized their lives and their work around the limited availability of light. As much work as possible was done during daylight and outdoors. People spent a significant portion of their own time and energy, particularly in Canada's long, dark winter, providing artificial lighting. Their efforts reflected and embodied the vernacular, household-managed, and locally or regionally available energy sources, such as wood for fires, the combustible fats of local fish and animals used in oil lamps, and the pervasive tallow lamps, all of these characteristics of the organic energy regime. It's local, people used it in very small quantities. It was difficult and sometimes impossible to safely negotiate interior spaces or the outdoors by relying exclusively on these kinds of dim, inconvenient, expensive, and often hazardous artificial lighting that characterized the pre-industrial era. The first modern fossil fuel-based lighting came from manufactured gas. Declining stocks of wood in Europe stimulated research into pneumatic chemistry, In the late 18th century, and gaslighting emerged as an accidental byproduct of a distillation process originally invented to produce tar, coke, and charcoal. It marked, as Canadian historian Leslie Thomery has argued, the first historic shift from, as he called it, the mill model to the network model, and from the artisanal to the scientific model that would come to define the Second Industrial Revolution. By the early years of the 19th century, manufactured gas was lighting mills and factories in England and the United States, and at a fraction of the cost of tallow candles. Manufactured gas arrived here in Toronto and Montreal in the late 1840s, and with it the first large-scale use of coal in Canada. By 1885, most major towns and cities across Canada had gas lighting plants. Widely used on streets and in public buildings, gas light in private homes was, however, nowhere near as prevalent in Canada as it was in Britain or the U.S. Whereas gas was providing, according to some recent estimates, was providing 80% of artificial light in Britain by 1900, fewer than 20% of Canadian households ever used manufactured gas, according to some statistics I've been recently gathering. Supply was a problem. Manufactured gas was delivered through centralized and specialized networks, a network system that worked well in Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver eventually, but was not cost-effective, of course, in delivering energy to Canada's rural majority. Before 1941, most Canadians, we now know, lived in rural and small-town communities with fewer than 1,000 people. Those population densities aren't really very good for a network system. But demand was also a problem. Even where it was available, gas light was too expensive for the urban working class majority. And a host of cultural factors and technological problems intervened between this new form of energy and its successful domestication within the home. Householders voiced an abundance of complaints, worrying about bad odors, leaks, fires, and explosions, as well as the vitiating effects of the gas. People constantly, people who spent a lot of time indoors, complained constantly about the headaches, that seemed to go with gas lighting. Fears that seem even more well-founded in light of what we now know about gaslight's remarkable toxic legacy. I could talk about that quite a bit, but one of the reasons we know what we know about gaslighting in Canada, which isn't very much, is because of the environmental studies that they've done of the toxic residues that have been left in the soils around at the foot of the Don River and all through southwestern Ontario in particular, but actually most major cities. The majority of households without access to manufactured gas were, however, making their own rapid turn to modern lighting of a different kind in the 1860s, kerosene or coal oil. The first demand for petroleum in Canada, as around the world, was driven by the demand for a liquid lighting fuel that was cheaper and more suitable than whale oil, that was brighter, easier to use, and more odor-free than the ubiquitous tallow candle, and the less dangerously explosive than the new 19th century turpentine-based lighting fluid, camphene, which took out a lot of people with unexpected explosions in their homes. Kerosene was first patented and named in 1854 by the Nova Scotia doctor and geologist Abraham Gessner. And the whole story of petroleum, I don't know that it's something we should be really proud of, but it really is a Canadian story. So the first, it was patented by Abraham Gessner. Inspired by the distillation process of obtaining gas lighting from coal, he was the first to distill a flammable hydrocarbon liquid from asphalt beds, which he called gum beds. In 1846, he gave the first public demonstration of coal oil lighting on Prince Edward Island. A Scientific American reported the resulting oil, quote, affords the cheapest, safest, and most agreeable light ever used, unquote, and at 1/17 the cost of whale oil. By 1856, Gessner's North American Kerosene Gas Light Company was refining bituminous coal from New Brunswick, believe it or not, shipped to New York to make illuminating oil in New York City. By the late 1850s, there were 33 coal oil manufacturing companies in the United States. The nascent coal oil industry established a market for non-organic illuminating oil, developed the lamp for effectively burning it and created the transportation infrastructure to move such a product from producers to consumers. Arguably, even more important, though, it stimulated the search for a source of illuminating fuel already in liquid form. Petroleum, as we would call it, petroleum or oil. It was a product whose use had been primarily medicinal. It's not a very pretty story to learn about the medicinal uses to this point. North America's first oil was discovered about 280 kilometers from here in southwestern Ontario, and the continent's first oil company, the International Mining and Manufacturing Company, was chartered there by Hamiltonian James Miller Williams and Charles Tripp on the 18th of December, 1854, 4 weeks earlier than the more famous Pennsylvania Rock Oil Company that Americans will tell you was... That was where oil was discovered, but they're wrong. In 1857, Williams designed and launched the first drilling rig and oil well, becoming a pioneer of its refinement and preparation for illuminating and lubricating purposes. Substantial production began in that year when Williams was already exporting the illuminating fluid to Toronto, Hamilton, London, and Sarnia, and as far away as New York. Prospectors began pouring into southwestern Ontario, and oil boom towns grew up overnight. By 1861, there were 400 wells and 100 refineries, most of them tiny, certainly by our standards. By 1863, the demand for the beautiful light resulted in refineries being built in London, Brantford, Ingersoll, Hamilton, Port Credit, and Toronto, all sites now of the terrible brownfield sites polluted by this and the gaslight industry. By 1865, Canada was the second largest supplier of kerosene to Europe after the United States, but even as early as 1865, the United States was already providing about 30 times as much as Canada. By 1869, 60 wells were in production and 3,000 barrels a week were being refined for export, mostly to the United States. By the 1870s, technologies and practices developed in southwestern Ontario were already being exported by Lambton County oil men, as they were called, who took their expertise around the world. So these guys from sort of rural southwestern Ontario learned how to create all these different technologies and practices. To Singapore, Argentina, Brazil, Cuba, Australia, Indonesia, Austria, Russia, Iraq, Iran, Baku, and elsewhere, helping to establish the industries in oil-rich regions of the world. And they wrote back to Lambton County newspaper describing their experiences there. So that's a wonderful source. Okay, unlike the process of making manufactured gas, converting crude petroleum to a marketable illuminating substance was firmly rooted in artisanal traditions. The drilling rig developed by Williams drew on methods first developed in China and used also in North America to mine salt. And here you can see them jumping up and down to pump that out. It was fairly quickly replaced by horsepower and then later by steam. It relied on first human, then animals, and later wood fueled steam power and later coal for the rapid, efficient, low-tech and small-scale extraction of petroleum. The equipment needed for refining the crude after it was extracted was almost identical as that used to create whiskey. Basically, the early refineries were just like a whiskey still. The oil was stored in hooped wooden barrels, still the standard of measuring oil today, in case you were wondering why we still talk about barrels of oil, despite their obsolescence at this point. Early transportation was a problem, as one petroleum historian put it. Those early drillers hauled their own oil, a few barrels at a time, to the nearest railhead, their oxen pulling long sleighs in the winter and flat-bottomed concrete sleds during the other months, the animals often haunched deep in the slick, gray, oil-infused mud along the road that the old drillers called the canal. Oil seepages, spills, and leaks declined with the creation of the first oil cars in the late 1860s and the extension of rail lines. Ontario's oil boom was intense but short-lived compared to the United States. Without any government regulation or oversight, the domestic industry tended to overproduce, not only driving prices down but dramatically reducing stocks of oil that might have been better preserved. The centralization and an increasing scale of production marked the oil processing industry by the late 19th century. In 1897, the conglomerate of Canadian local producers, Imperial Oil, was finally bought out by Standard Oil of New Jersey, which since 1880 had been refining about 90% of all American crude petroleum. Maybe some of you know that terrible story about Standard Oil and their attempt to get a successful attempt to monopolize oil. The volume of kerosene being refined continued to increase past the end at the beginning of the 20th century, rising in 1915 to 2.8 million gallons and hitting an all-time high in 1917 of 40 million gallons. By that point, a lot of it was American oil that was being imported, really, after 1910, the production of kerosene is still increasing, but what is really increasing is the amount of oil that's being refined into gasoline, because the internal combustion engine had by that point been invented. And I should have shown the graph, because the difference, the increase is, it's spectacular. You can't even, maybe I'll show you at the end, you can't even see the 19th century production, because it increases so rapidly after 1910 and again after 1940. As Ian Drummond points out, though, the continued importance of kerosene is a reminder of how many people, most of them part of Canada's rural and small town majority, still relied on it as their main form of lighting. As this graph shows, in 1941, 80% of rural Canadian farm households still relied on kerosene for their main form of lighting, and the proportion was much higher in some parts of the country. I'm trying to find out exactly how much was used in urban areas. But a lot was used in cities like Toronto. The working classes relied on kerosene as well, right through probably till about 1910 or 1920, when electricity began to replace it. From the point of view of the consumer, kerosene was cheap, easy to use, and accessible to individual households in a way that gas and later electric lighting simply were not. As I said, kerosene was adopted a lot more quickly and easily than people responded to electricity and gas. Key to its popularity was the fact that it was amenable to rural distribution in this rural country at the time. By the 1880s, transportation networks of ship and rail linked central Canadian and later American supplies of oil to central oil depots across the country, from which horse-drawn tankers moved the oil along the same road bringing other goods to rural households. This is not at all what was happening, of course, with moving electricity. General stores installed metal tanks, rather like gasoline pumps today, to dispense calibrated quantities of the fluid into non-refillable containers, refillable containers that were a standard element in rural homes right through into the 1950s. More portable and accessible than manufactured gas inside the home and barn, it provided a bright, strong, smoke-free light, and after a series of chemical procedures had been invented and applied, it was almost odorless, and after a series of government regulations in the 1880s, it was almost non-explosive. A modification in lamp design, needed because of coal oil's greater flammability, made the illuminating fluid not only cheaper, safer, and brighter, but also much easier to use than candles and earlier lamps. So while the fuel was new, its use nevertheless fell within familiar patterns of lighting. As Loris, as our famous Canadian historian of lighting put it, Loris Russell, the farmer going about his pre-dawn chores, the student cramming for his examinations, the workman on the night shift, the actor behind the footlights, each had a brighter, cheaper, and safer source of light. Better and cheaper, it still worked within domestic spaces and in the same way that candles and the familiar earlier oil lamps did. It was just better. Familiarity, indeed, emerges as an important component of kerosene's rapid and relatively smooth acceptance. But if kerosene's production grew from artisanal roots and part of its appeal was the familiarity of use as a lighting source, it differed vastly in terms of the consequences attendant on its extraction, processing, transportation, and consumption. Thanks. Got it. Kerosene accidents were reported with some frequency in the home and the upsetting or bursting of a coal oil lamp. But the worst problems of kerosene were not experienced at the point of consumption, but of extraction and transportation and waste products. The extraction of the oil itself could be highly dangerous. Oil was often found with explosive natural gas, a factor which created the much publicized gushers where the force of the exploding gases pushed the oil out without the time consuming and expensive process of drilling. They also wanted to use, they would actually put explosives into the oil so that it would do that, resulting in terrible, absolutely terrible environmental degradation, which I'll go on to talk about now. Similar dangers attended the refineries. Refineries were typically located near waterways to facilitate not only cheap transportation of the oil to and from the plants, but the ready disposal of the unwanted byproducts of processing. If the crude contained a high level of sulfur, as much as the crude in Ontario did, an alkali solution of lead oxide and sulfuric acid was needed to, as they called it, clean the oil. So when it was typically, those products were typically dumped directly into a nearby river. John William Kerr, a fisheries inspector for Western Lake Ontario, living in Hamilton, reported in the 1860s that, quote, fish caught in the Sherman Inlet tasted of coal oil emitted from the two refineries at the water's edge along the railway tracks, unquote. According to his estimates, about 360 gallons of sulfuric acid ran into the inlet every week. The Canadian News reported in 1862 that in Hamilton, the water on certain mornings is covered for a considerable distance with oil, and the effect has been to drive away fish from the beach. By the 1870s, health officials reported wells in the vicinity of the oil works in London were being destroyed by spent acid. Gasoline, an unwanted and highly explosive product of the kerosene production, was dumped into nearby rivers and lands. And it was largely responsible for the deadly fires that became associated with kerosene refining. Jacob Engelhart's London refinery caught fire three times in 1870 alone, killing one employee and badly injuring several others. In 1883, the Imperial Oil Refinery was struck by lightning and the entire premises destroyed by fire. So just to conclude here, as Andrew Hurley has argued, is one of the many explosions. The suburban industrial developments drawing together clusters of highly polluting industries were the face of the second industrial revolution being launched in the 1860s, comprising a series of technological innovations that enabled, this is a quote from Hurley, manufacturers to maximize economic efficiency by mechanizing production, applying the principles of modern sciences, consuming large doses of fossil fuel energy, and expanding markets beyond local boundaries. The provision of cheap lighting for the masses was a significant stimulant to the creation of these toxic industrial suburbs. Adopted for lighting because of its accessibility, familiarity, high quality, low cost, and portability within the house and farm, kerosene nevertheless worked materially and culturally as part of the new industrial energy regimes as gas, light, and electricity, reducing reliance on locally produced materials, liberating human populations for the first time from dependence on the daily and seasonal rhythms, integrating households within complex and anonymous fossil fuel network systems, and generating some alarming environmental consequences in the process. Thank you.
You've been listening to a recording of Ruth Sandwell's talk, The 1860s and the Origins of Canada's Transition to Fossil Fuels. The talk was delivered on April 22, 2017, as part of the Other 60s, a decade that shaped Canada and the world, a symposium hosted by the Department of History at the University of Toronto. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca, and be sure to subscribe to the History Chats podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.